raised my knees and steal my spine, while the waiting room dropped it into cheers. He's been asking for that for years. You pried the scissors from your leg, ripped my apron up and tied a tourniquet.
MayWorks, the annual celebration of labor in the arts, is seeking submissions from workers and artists alike from now until March 15th. All mediums and ideas are welcome so long as they depict working class life or speak to labor's struggle to build a better world. And it doesn't matter if you're an established artist honoring the working class or a worker seeking to explore and express your own life. Submit a description of your idea to info@mayworks.org by March 15th. While the MayWorks Festival runs throughout the month of May, ideas for events in late April and early June are welcome. So help make this celebration of labor and the arts more than a month and become part of the city's rich history of labor by sending us your submission today. The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 19th to 23rd. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring New York experimental hardcore trio Show Me the Body as guest curator, incisive Chicago rapper Mick Jenkins, LA indie rockers Cherry Glazer, genre-bending rap artist Carrie Faux, Montreal-based hip-hop trio Planet Giza, 70s Zamrock revivalist Witch, renowned Sandscape composer Laurel Halo, British electronic producer Forest Swords, eminent post-punk three-piece Wombo, Philadelphia hardcore punk group Soul Glow, and many more. Plus, there's over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Michael Lysenko, an interdisciplinary artist, designer, and researcher working in the bioart field. Michael graduated with a Bachelor of Environmental Science and a Master in Landscape Architecture from the University of Manitoba, then completed his Master in Fine Arts at the University of Windsor in Ontario. Michael has received numerous awards and fellowships, such as the Emerging Artist Award at Nuit Blanche in Winnipeg and the Manitoba Graduate Scholarship for Landscape Architecture. He's exhibited in such events as the Tech Art Fair at the Ontario Science Centre in Toronto and the show Human Nature Augmented Screening SOCA Incubator Lab in Windsor, Ontario. Michael has published works, a student feature in View magazine. He has done performances, installations, and numerous presentations, such as Cybernetic Ecologies in Mexico City, and has been an artist in residence in Nevers, France. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
You have a very innovative practice. Looking back, what would be your earliest memories of your interest in art and your curiosity about science?
I think growing up, I know my mom always tells me that I was able to just name cars that whip past me in the stroller even. So I think there's just something about machines and that kind of captivated me. And then growing up, my friends and I would always be tearing electronics apart, trying to make stuff. So I guess we come by it honestly. But I think once I entered into university is probably when I actually really stepped into gear and started finding more productive ways to explore those things.
Can you tell us about your university studies and how science, art, and environmental design came together for you?
Yeah, for sure. So I would call my university career definitely the scenic route. I went in expecting to be in engineering. And after about a year of that, I realized that my brain is just not programmed in that way and I wasn't doing very well. So I think I was bouncing around trying to find what fit me, and I finally settled in the environmental science department. And there was just something about those issues and that curriculum that really piqued my interest. And I ended up moving around a fair amount in terms of what I focused on in there, using GIS and some different approaches. But near the very end, I got interested in a green design course. And with some of that knowledge, I ended up going on a short trip to Churchill as a research study course, also focusing on green design. And so I think that sort of grabbed me and pulled me into the design direction.
Would you like to tell us what drew you to study rivers and space in Windsor and the projects or installations that you did that led up to this?
Growing up, I spent a lot of time cycling around the river trails in Winnipeg. So I think it's just a space and an environment that just a bit near and dear to to my heart. And there's just something comforting about being in that space. And so when I first moved to Windsor, I was trying to explore the city. And I think I naturally was looking for some bike paths, which are often along rivers, and just really sensing some big differences between what I knew from home and what I was experiencing now in Windsor. And just the amount of industry that lined up along the river's edge, it was just really kind of grabbed me. And a lot of the work that I do ends up having a bit of a focus point. And so I think the river it just sort of clicked as this is a great thing to aim my fine arts degree at right now.
And so have you had any other projects that have reflected that interest in rivers and water?
When I finished that program, I was just finishing as COVID started up. And normally as part of our program, we would have a year-end final exhibition of our work as a thesis component. And so that never happened. So I was just stuck with this mostly built exhibition. But I still felt very strongly about what had come out of that. And while looking for some opportunities during that time, I signed up for an entrepreneurship mentorship program. And it was 2 months in the summer. And if you got accepted, you had a bit of funding to basically get a product rolling. And so I was thinking, how can I bundle that thesis work and make something in this realm with that? So the thesis was going to be called The Environment Machine Shop. So that's almost like the branding or the nameplate I wanted to move forward with. So I pitched that in this entrepreneurship program and I got in. So I was prototyping what I called a water quality detector. So it was a little handheld unit with some sensors that you could bring to your river or water body that you wanted to spend time with or you were curious about. And you could just get some information like the pH, the temperature. I think it took a few other readings as well. But just another way to use that energy and that idea and find a different avenue to reach people with.
Would you like to tell us about how an earlier work of yours, Cyborg Plant, came about and how you brought that together?
I think I've always had a strong interest in technology. And a book that I was handed in early in my landscape architecture studies, essentially it was talking about how instrumentation and technology can be used as a conduit to give us a different view on our surroundings in the landscape. And that really stuck with me. And I was wondering what technologies I might use. And in my program, I was introduced to MaxMSP, which is a media arts visual coding environment, and a little chip called the Arduino, ubiquitous with the DIY electronics movement these days. And I was just trying to figure out what to do with these devices. And I was thinking about getting away from having to use an iPad or some kind of intermediary to get that extra information out of the landscape. And I was thinking, how could I integrate these elements into our landscape? And that's where the Cyborg Plant came from, is this idea of how do I bring technology and plants together in some way to explore that. So the premise of the thesis work that came out of that ended up being looking at technology as a way to protect plants in our environment. And so in this case, the idea of protection came out as providing us with an awareness of the plant's existence or changes in the plant. And so, and then using the technology to make that happen. So with the Arduino and some code and some sensors, we were able to read the electrical signals in the plant, which are roughly akin to say like an EKG in a human muscle. So there are these transmission signals that tell the roots and the leaves and everything can be connected. And so we're able to intercept those and just detect them. And then translate that into sound pitches. So you could hear when things were changing based on some pitch changes. And that ended up being a very powerful, what I've been calling it is a transcription. I'm trying to transcribe whatever information is coming into a different language, if you will, I guess for our ears, because we can't hear or see these signals otherwise. So in that way, the plants was augmented with this technology.
You work across a lot of media. Can you give us an example how some of these come together in a work such as Pollution Piano and walk us through your creative process as you built this piece?
I guess often I'm challenged when I have to describe what I am or what title I would hold. I don't have certifications as an architect, so I wouldn't say I'm an architect. But I think what best describes me is maker, problem solver, and transdisciplinary researcher. And I think the transdisciplinary part for me is really not just recognizing multiple disciplines together and seeing how they can answer the same question, but actually trying to merge them a bit or pull tools from one and another and really mix them up a bit. And I think the approach, I don't even know initially if that was intentional, but that seems to be the approach I take. And so I also work with a lot of technology, a lot of DIY technology, and I end up making a small system. Once I have that working well, I can plug that into another artwork to help it answer some questions or do some performance for me. So part of it, I think, is about building up that toolkit as well and expanding it as I can and letting each project inform the next. So I've been really interested in using some wireless data transmission technology called LoRa, but I haven't had quite an application yet. I'm looking at another project that would maybe integrate that. And that project is very research-based, but from that work, I can also imagine some artworks that might come out of that too. So I guess I like to think about each of these different disciplines as problem-solving tools for me to approach these different problems. And I'd say I just put environmental advocacy and empathy maybe in the middle, and all these tools and artworks and or just the different ways that I can use to approach getting to that center question.
What's most valuable about the experience of actually being on site to collect your data, and what tools do you use when you're on site?
So I guess I'll preface this with saying the explorations around the river right now, I would hesitate to call them like purely scientific. So certain types of collection biases or whatever methods you would use to make a more exacting measurement would not be quite in play here. It's a bit more off the cuff, a bit more intuitive, I think. So a lot of times my site planning might be just passive. I'm doing visits, I'm probably cycling and some areas catch my eye, or I'm looking at a map and see something that looks interesting. GIS can come in just to give some context. For example, depending on the zoning around a site, that could change quite a bit what sort of use is happening there, what buildings are there. So, but that might not be very obvious right there. So sometimes that background data is helpful. And it also, you can pull some shapes out of that, like a shape of a river, for instance, that might have some value as an image to explore. And then my site tools right now are actually quite basic. So I try to keep true to the citizen science DIY tools and methods. So my water collector, for instance, is just a carved out 4-liter milk jug and a rope, and that's served me just fine for the time being. Lately, I will be bringing probably a sound recorder, my camera, the water jug I described, and some sample bottles. So it's pretty simple. I'd like to bring my water collector tool a little bit more frequently, but I'm still working out the bugs to make sure it's quite accurate enough. And then I think part of it is just sitting with the site and just being there and just taking in what it feels like. And to answer your question about what's the difference for me for being there or not being there, I think map data or any data that you collect is always has some sort of bias in it related to the reason in which it was collected in the first place. So a researcher who is asking for a data set doesn't have the same concerns that your research question is. So naturally, whatever they've collected might not suit that question as well, but it may represent some things around you. And so it can be misleading. And I think especially with GIS, a lot of times maps are being generated by people putting the data in, and that map is made of only the data that I've thought to grab. So you get personal limitations about this environment that we create in GIS. And so it's a bit humbling to just go and be and sit with the place. Even for me, I found that some of the sites I tried to visit or choose to sample didn't really work out once I got there in the real world because of access or other situations. So just being there also awarded me that perspective and information that I couldn't get off of a map anyway. So
you've also been in a number of exhibitions and fairs. Can you tell us about a few of these and what the experiences were like for you?
Those would have happened while I was doing my Master's of Fine Arts degree. And so most of the time when you're exhibiting work in an art context, a gallery is a no-brainer. It's a very assumed place to put your artwork, right? And so the program more specifically that I was involved in was the bio art program there at the university. I didn't have an arts background, really. My formal introduction to the arts was through design school at the U of M in landscape architecture. So I was already coming from a strange angle when presenting my works or even just thinking about how to display them in the context of an art school. I think being able to head to these fairs, I guess some of them were science fairs, so they're also aimed at a very different crowd than you might expect as an artist. And so the curious thing was these works weren't really up in front of the scrutiny of professors or art critics. It was in front of children and their parents and the general public. And children are very honest. And I just remember having to like defend my material choices to an 8-year-old boy who's like, what's this for? Oh, I can tell what you used there. So it's a very different kind of a critique that you get. But for me, that work was really about reaching those people anyway. And I think if I came only from a very traditional arts context, I don't know that I would have felt as okay in that environment as I found myself. So it was a curious challenge, but I think that feels more like the playing field that I want to be at anyway.
Do you have the option to be in that kind of a playing field at this point?
I think so. The media arts scene in Winnipeg has really been growing in years past, and it seems like there's more of a hunger for content around the environment and climate change and science communication and technology. So in some ways, I think this is pretty timely to get these kinds of works out of the galleries and into places that are more socially accessible. They're probably not just the easiest option or the most obvious one, but I think there are possibilities for sure.
When you were in Nevers, France, for the artist residency you did, tell us a bit about this residency and what you found most valuable about doing this.
That was a curious space. That was the first time that residency had ever been run. And to me, the overarching theme there was critical making. And so this idea of questioning making processes, questioning technology, being disruptive with it, circumventing it. And so I was at a point where I really needed something fresh, and this popped up, and it seemed like a very good fit and a wonderful excuse to head to France. And there's also some leaders academically on those topics that were going to be there. Unfortunately, in residencies that are a bit shorter, it's hard to bring complex projects to fruition. So we had to somewhat limit the ambition of our projects, but I partnered with a friend I met there, Shauna, and we ended up making an installation that helped people explore the square a little bit. We had these little nodes with a network that you'd walk up to connect, and it would just hit your phone with some instructions, part of a poem and a clue to get to the next node. And it would give you a little Easter egg hunt around the city square that we were staying in. So not exactly focused on environmental issues, but for me, I think I learned so much about being less scared about exploring technology and worrying about breaking it, just getting in there. A lot of skills using Raspberry Pi, which is another piece of technology that I use pretty frequently for my installations. And so it's just a very formative place to get messy with these tools. And I use them all the time. So I would say a pretty priceless experience for sure.
Would you recommend other artists get involved in residencies?
Absolutely. I think one of the hardest things to do is set time aside to focus on one thing for a little bit. And if nothing else, a residency is that blocked out excuse of time that's there for one purpose, to do that thing. So that alone, I think, is worth it. And often too, just the opportunity to travel and situate somewhere else has been incredible, just to see how, get some context for things. And oftentimes you're meeting very interesting people who are trying to get a read on your work. And I think a lot of times with residencies too, they build in many chances for exposure and interaction. And it's not often that you get so much feedback from people that are willing to sit down and spend time with your work. So that's also a wonderful privilege that comes with that. Yes, I definitely recommend it.
You've won a number of awards for your work, such as the Emerging Artist Award at Nuit Blanche in Winnipeg for the installation Electro Smog Detector. Can you tell us about this work?
Nuit Blanche is a festival that's near and dear to my heart. It's probably one of the first art festivals that really grabbed me. The chance to participate in one of them was a very touching moment as well, just because it was something that was special. It was such a special night to take part in, and then to actually contribute was wonderful. So the Electro Smog Detector project, my friend and I, we purchased an old cabinet radio and took all the hardware out and replaced it with some Arduinos and some antennas. And what we were trying to do was allow people to use the interface of the radio to tune into different frequency bands and be able to read the connection happening. So we wanted to see if people around it with cell phones would set off these little lights, just to give people, again, that sort of looking glass into this invisible energy that's around us. Some of it didn't quite work as we planned, but I think it was a really fun exhibit. And I think what's interesting too about having it at Nuit Blanche is it's just out there in the city. It's a gallery like no other. I love that idea of just out walking and you stumble into this strange, mysterious object and it gives you an adventure to go on. So it teaches you, I think, very quickly about user interfaces and how do I get this crowd of people with no primer to follow through using this thing the way I hope they would. That's also something you learn pretty fast out there. But again, it was just another opportunity to test some of these pieces together. So every project is a test bed for something.
Were you surprised and happy with some of the responses to the electrosmog detector that you had there?
Yeah, for sure. We tried to get some pictures of people interacting with it, but it just seemed to bring people joy. That was all about that one.
If you'd like to go back to the pollution piano and tell us a little bit about the presentation in class.
Some of the origins of that project happened in Nevers, just stumbling into my environment and being inspired by things around me. On my way home, I went through Paris and went to this wonderful museum on technology. And they had a section with Victorian era science instruments. And it was stunning, like microscopes just adorned with carvings and beautiful brass hardware. And there was just something about those objects that commanded a respect or had such a strong intention about them. It just felt like you were going to do something important with this object. And I don't know what it is. It really stuck with me. Maybe it was just this idea of care that passed through it, unlike the cold equipment that we're often faced with using now. That just simmered for a while. And I started playing with measuring different things in the water. And so that's where I got the idea to play with conductivity. And when you're measuring conductivity in a water sample, it can't tell you anything particularly specific, but it can tell you that there's things in there that are causing the water to be more conductive. And so that can, in an urban context, look like heavy metals or salts from road runoff, etc. So they're a general signal that there's some disruption happening in that waterway. So it seemed like a good one to use. And also conductivity is something I can measure in volts, which communicates very well with a lot of the equipment that I'm using. So it just seemed like a very convenient connection between those two. So I don't even know if I can imagine where the piano came from, but I thought of this idea to try to measure the samples in a row and then activate them each with a key, which ended up being a piano. So the object looked like a row of piano keys and then a piece of copper as a stand to hold all of the water samples with lights under them. So, and that's part of that user interaction. How do I make sure that whoever's playing the piano knows which sample they have activated? So that's where some of the lights come from. And then I like to play that up a bit and add more lights and have the object be enjoyable. And so again, being inspired by some of those Victorian objects, I made this one out of wood with a nice dark stain, and I used a lot of copper piping. And I was finding materials that were easy to work with hand tools. So that puts wood and copper solders up very nicely with just a blowtorch. You don't need any special equipment. So again, drawing on that DIY DNA. And then once I started building it up, I really wanted to celebrate the possibility of what being on that keyboard could do. So it was already quite a digital instrument because it was using an Arduino. And so I just went and embraced the synthesizer view. So I ended up adding some knobs and some controls that made it more, allowed you to control some of the sound properties. So you could change the attack and decay of the notes and how much it modulates and those sort of normal synthesizer things. But the idea comes from how can I make thinking about the environment or thinking about water quality more inviting and a bit more playful while still keeping it serious. And so when you get a reading off of the pollution piano, it doesn't give you a number, it just gives you a pitch. And so depending on how conductive the water is or how much salt or heavy metals are in the water, you'll get a higher pitch. And if it was distilled water, you would get no pitch. There'd be no conductivity at all. So again, you'll just play this piano and I don't see numbers, but I can hear very quickly those distinctions. And so to me, that's enough for some situations. And so in the class where I gave you guys that lecture, in that case, the piano was acting almost as a map and it was a sampling of a bunch of those water samples across a couple of sites on some rivers. So you could hear very quickly how the river was changing across the piano and across the land. It's a quick way to hear and compare. And sometimes too, what's nice, I ran a workshop once where I pulled just the conductivity meter out had like a little speaker and two probes, and I asked people to just bring in different liquids to test. And so I brought a sample from the bay, some snow that we had melted, and we could hear all the differences. Yeah, it was very interesting to be able to benchmark it against other things in your life, or liquids that you come across, coffee or juice or tea. So I think, again, using that transcribing into sound as a tool to make understanding those things easier or more enjoyable or captivating.
So what do you see yourself doing in the next 5 years?
That's always a tough question. Right now, I'm just following the good energy. And that's sort of how I ended up here in this PhD program at the U of M. And I think I'm going to continue to do that. I hope it's something that isn't involving a teaching component and some sort of practice component. But I think making and trying to help shift our way out of climate change or just a better solution to address climate change is always going to be, I think, at the center of my work. So I'm not quite sure what the things around it look like yet, but I'm just going to keep heading in that direction.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and valuable insight with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thanks for having me.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Tonight, I'd like to leave you with a song by French-Canadian artist Rock Voisine. The song is entitled Lace La Revere.
La rêver, regarder dans le ciel les étoiles dorées, les jours de grand soleil. Laisse-la rêver, qu'elle peut voler plus haut, même si elle en veut trop. Laisse-la rêver à sa façon, laisse-la danser ce verre, ses illusions, briser son cœur pour un garçon. Oui, you are not. Laisse-la monter jusqu'aux étoiles, et si elle retombe et se fait mal, tends-lui les bras, dis-lui tout bas, tu peux compter sur moi. Laisse-la partir, oublie le temps qui passe. Souviens-toi qu'à son âge, la vie est un beau grand voyage. Laisse-la partir, mais dis-lui que tu l'aimes sans trop la retenir. Laisse-la rêver à sa façon, laisse-la danser ce merci d'illusion, briser son cœur pour un garçon. Oui ou non, laisse-la monter jusqu'aux étoiles, et si elle retombe et se fait mal, tends-lui les bras, dis-lui tout bas, tu peux compter sur moi. Laisse-la rêver à sa façon, laisse-la danser, se bercer d'illusions, briser son cœur pour un garçon. Un oui ou un non. Laisse-la monter jusqu'aux étoiles. Et si elle retombe et se fait mal, tends-lui les bras, dis-lui tout bas, tu peux compter sur moi.
Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
UMFM 101.5 broadcasts at 1200 watts from the University of Manitoba, located on Treaty 1 territory, the original lands of the Anishinaabeg, Nahiwak, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation.
If you got what it takes, 'cause I'm KRS and I'm on the mic and premieres on the breaks. I never won a Grammy, I won't win a Tony, but I'm not the only MC keeping it real. When I grab the mic and smash a rapper, girls go ill. Check the time as I rhyme, it's 1995 whenever I arrive. The party gets liver, flow with the master rhymer. As I leap behind a video rapper, you know the chart climber, tapper. Down goes another rapper, on to another matter. Punch up the data, blast master. Knowledge reigns supreme over nearly everybody. Call a KRS and guaranteed to rip a party. Flat top braids, foreheads, or Nazi dread. There once was a story about a man named Jed. But now Jed is dead, all his kids instead wanna kick drums up the top of their head. Word, we'll go around, come around, I figure. Now we got white kids calling themselves niggas. The tables turn as the crosses burn. Remember, you must learn about the styles I flip and how wild I get. I go on like a space age rocket ship. You could be a Mac, a pimp, hustler, a player, but make sure live you is a dope rhyme slayer. MCs act like they don't know. 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 This is what you waited all year for. The hardcore, that's what KRS is here for. Big up Grand Wizard Theodore getting ill. If you see, then you saw. I mean, you grew with mad skill. MCs can only battle with rhymes that got punchlines. Let's battle and see who headlines. Instead of flow for flow, let's go show for show. So